About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ralph Cutter, and he'll be answering your most important questions on golden trout of the High Sierra. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ralph Cutter about golden trout of the High Sierra. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Ralph, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight for our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for our drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Ralph's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Ralph Cutter's book, Fish Food, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And you can find out more about all the books that Stackpole has to offer at www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be something that Ralph and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you win Ralph's book, Fish Food, which is an excellent book on what fish eats. So I know you'll enjoy it. Well, tonight our guest is Ralph Cutter. For the past 30 years, Ralph and his wife, Lisa, have run the California School of Fly Fishing. In pursuit of trout, they have logged well over 4,000 miles throughout the High Sierra backcountry. They have guided and hosted trips in Alaska, Mexico, Belize, and Peru. They recently returned from a scientific expedition in Papua New Guinea, where they lived for a month and documented fish species in a never-before-explored jungle caldera. Ralph has written hundreds of articles and contributed over a dozen books on fly fishing and aquatic ecology. His book, Sierra Trout Guide, has sold over 70,000 copies, and his other book, Fish Food, is one of Stackpole's bestsellers. He's a columnist for the California Fly Fisher magazine and past editor of Fly Fishing West and Adventure West magazines. The Cutters produced and filmed the video Bugs of the Underworld, which won numerous international awards and has been the top-selling video in its class 3 years running. Ralph and Lisa were instrumental in the discovery of the first new trout species described in the past 6 decades. It was discovered in the remote Sierra Madre backcountry of central Mexico, and of course, it was caught on a fly. The Cutters are ardent conservationists and life members of Trout Unlimited. Ralph and Lisa were inducted into the Federation Fly Fishers Hall of Fame in 2000. Well, Ralph, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing, and it's good to have you back.
Hey, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
So finally, folks, we've got this done. We've got Ralph on the line. The teleconference system is working, and we're good to go. And I'm well, so got rid of the crud, so we're set to go now. So we're going to have a good show tonight, and I'm excited about it. So we got lots of questions, as usual, and this is something we've never done a show on, and so it'll be very interesting to me. It's new material for me as well, so we're going to have some fun with this. Let's just see here. Okay. And we'll check something here. All right. Okay. Got lots of people on the line. All right. So, Ralph, let's just dig right in here. Let's do a little background on Sierra Nevada.
Okay.
The range itself. Now, as everybody knows from our description, you and Lisa spent your honeymoon and pretty much walked the whole range there, I think. So you must have a pretty good idea of where it starts and where it ends. So you want to fill us in, give us a little geography lesson?
Sure. You know, there's actually a lot of debate about where the Sierra starts and stops. And from my perspective, I would believe that the Sierra starts at the Kern Plateau, which is about equidistant with Bakersfield, California, going to the east. And it ends, somewhere between just north of Reno, between Reno and Sacramento, right above Lake Tahoe. The range starts to taper off, and then we get into the Intermountain Range that Lake Davis lives in, and then we move up into the Lassen Range. So it's about 600 miles long, and it's in the heart of California, and it's the least populated place in the country.
In the country?
Yes.
Well, I should say California,
in the lower 48.
Okay.
Not a lot, but it's amazing that you can have, you know, California being so populous, and then you get to the Sierra, and, you know, per square mile, there's fewer people there than any place else.
Well, there's probably few parking spaces for your sports car up there. Right? Well, we know everybody in California is blonde and drives a sports car, right?
Except for me. I've got brown hair and bald hair and drive a truck.
Drive a truck, yeah, there you go. So what species of trout inhabit the Sierra Nevada besides the golden?
Are you talking about indigenous species, species that naturally live here, or fish that have been introduced?
Well, both.
The Sierra really only had two fish species. About 10,000 years ago, of course, we had our last, you know, quote-unquote ice age that came over the Sierra, wiped out all the fish and basically sterilized the system. And there were only two rivers that allowed fish to get back up into the mountains. And on the north end, that was the Truckee River that came out of the Lahontan Sea where Reno is now. And so we had cutthroat come up in the Lahontan, Carson, would be the Carson, Walker, and Truckee River drainages, very small drainages. And so we got Lahontan cutthroat in there and one very small relic population of Paiute cutthroat trout. And then on the very far south end of the range, fish were able to come up from what was then the inland sea of California through the, you know, where the San Joaquin Valley is, and ascend the Kern River and populate areas up to maybe 7,000 feet in the Kern. So those evolved into the golden trout, and on the north end we got the cutthroat trout, and that was it. The rest of the Sierra was completely devoid of any kind of fish.
And so, of course, rainbows were introduced there, right?
Yeah, well, actually the trout that moved up the Kern River was probably a precursor to both the rainbow and the golden trout. It really wasn't, probably closer related to the red band trout that we see today than either the golden or today's rainbow. And those rainbows moved up the Kern River. They became isolated as the glaciers receded, the water, you know, receded. They got stuck up there, and they evolved into actually three species of golden trout, the Volcano Creek or the California golden trout, the Little Kern golden trout, and then another fish that looks like a rainbow trout, and it's called a rainbow trout. It's called the Gilberti rainbow in the Kern River itself, but it's probably closer related to the goldens than it is to the rainbows.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah, Rudy in Valencia, California had written in, and he was asking about this. And you said that one of his questions was which geologic water basin goldens come from. So
that would be the Kern River.
Okay.
And actually very, very small drainage. I mean, most of the goldens are not a high elevation fish. They're a relatively low elevation fish adapted to waters that reach 80 degrees in the summertime and strictly a creek fish. But, you know, through our management efforts, we've planted them all throughout the entire Sierra, in fact, into the Rockies, into Canada, and some other places. And I think most people now think of them as lake fish, but that's not where they came from.
Yeah, yeah. And one of his questions, too, he really had several good questions here. He says, how do you know when you have a heritage golden trout?
Ooh, good question. I would think that you would have a heritage golden trout if you catch a golden trout within its historic range. If you caught a golden trout in the Kern River drainage, I think that would count.
Okay. And what is considered the a heritage golden trout? Is that
okay? California has a pretty cool system, California Fish and Game, where if you can go out and catch, I think believe it's five fish, native fish, within their indigenous range where they grew up with that before they got planted, you get what's called a heritage trout award. You get a placard and a, you know, a credit of appreciation. And so for people going to get their heritage trout, if they want to get a heritage golden trout, they need to go into the Kern River watershed. Even though you can catch golden trout, you know, all up and down the range, if you want a heritage trout, you better go to their native range.
Okay. Another question he had, he said, and I don't know about this lawsuit, so maybe you can explain this too. He says, will the lawsuit on stocking hatchery fish help preserve goldens and other native trout of California?
Hey, Roger, I'm sorry. We had an incoming call in here that just blanked you out there for a second.
Okay.
So can you repeat the question?
Well, sure. Will the lawsuit on stocking hatchery fish help preserve golden and other native trout of California?
Yes, absolutely. The biggest threat to golden trout right now is hybridization with other non-native trout. Gold or rainbow trout have infiltrated, you know, planted rainbow trout have infiltrated the genetic backbone of these goldens, and that probably is the single biggest threat to them. So by eliminating or reducing the planting of rainbows, it will help by reducing or eliminating the planting of, you know, non-native brook trout and brown trout. That will help the native golden trout and the Lahontan cutthroats.
And last question was, what is the significance of the name change of DFG? That he's talking about.
The, you know, Department of Fish and Game has been called the Department of Fish and Game for probably since it was the California Fish Commission back in the 30s. The name was changed just this year to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I think that's a pretty reasonable approach because California Fish, you know, Game is only a very specific kind of wildlife, and Fish and Game is tasked with managing, you know, rabbits and shrews and gophers and everything else that may not be game animals. So I think it's more accurate to call it the Department of Fish and Wildlife rather than the Department of Fish and Game.
Okay. So no significance then?
No, it's really just, it's more symbolic than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Another question from Jerry Crow in New Hampshire. He says, forget about the trout. I want to learn about the nine-month honeymoon.
What part does he want to know that?
But then he says, about the trout, are they naturally reproducing or are they stocked?
Both. Both. California has a very robust hatchery program and backcountry stocking program. And there are many, many waters that are planted where there is natural reproduction going on. And there actually is really no reason to be planting these waters. Fish tend to equal themselves out pretty well in an environment given, you know, left to their own defenses. And when you start dumping a bunch of extra fish on that population, it does nothing but screw things up. And in other areas, we have lakes that would be totally fishless unless they were planted every year or every 2 years. So we have both. We have naturally reproducing stocks, and we have stocks that are dependent on planting.
So, and you said they've now been introduced to many parts of the Sierra Nevada. Is that correct, or even beyond that?
The golden trout?
Yeah.
Yeah, goldens have been planted in well over 300 lakes in the Sierra, which is kind of a cool thing. There have been some pretty strong negative things about this. I mean, they do impact indigenous or native species, but they've also opened up angling opportunities to a lot of people in a lot of places that no one would have ever been to before. So, yeah, we've got goldens all up and down the Sierra now where originally they were isolated in a very, very small watershed.
And there's actually, I was looking at your book here, you've got identified Little Kern golden trout, and then you've also got Volcano Creek golden trout. So there is some difference in the visual.
Yeah, they're
actually of those, but,
quite distinct fish. And when I wrote that book, we actually had we had two kinds of golden trout on the east side of the Kern River. We called them the Kern River, the South Kern River golden trout, or the Kern River golden trout, and the Volcano Creek golden trout. They have since been lumped into one name just called the California golden trout. There really isn't a lot of difference between the two. If you go to the west side of the Kern River, we have the Little Kern golden trout. And the difference between that is we had three different runs of fish come up the Kern River as we had big pulses of of meltwater come down. First, it was this rainbow-like fish that got isolated and evolved into the golden trout. Maybe 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 years later, we had another pulse of water, allowed another pulse of rainbow-like fish to come in. And they interbred with these golden trout and kind of got, you know, schlepped off to the side into the little kern drainage. And they evolved into something that's, oh, just quite a bit different than the California golden trout. And then on the third pulse, we ended up with these rainbow-type fish that got isolated in the main stem of the kern, and those became our Gilberti rainbow trout. So we really have three goldens right now.
And is it easy to tell them apart visually? Or is it
yes, very easy to tell them apart. The California golden trouts are brilliant. They've got bright orange on their bellies. When they get big, they pretty much lose their par marks. They don't have much speckling on them. The little kern goldens have a lot of speckling. They tend to be more pale. They tend to look a little more like rainbow trout. They're not very impressive to look at. And then the Kern River rainbows, you pretty much wouldn't know them from a rainbow trout out of the McLeod River or New Zealand or any other place. You know, genetically speaking, they're different, but looking at them heuristically, they're pretty much the same as any other rainbow.
Okay. Okay, good. Let's take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about the California's golden trout. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ralph Cutter about golden trout of the High Sierra. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let me just check in here, Ralph, and a couple of questions coming in on the Internet. This part of the show, I was asking my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world and what is going on. Anything new with you? Any new books, articles, adventures?
Oh, actually, we're relaxing right now. Sierra Trout Guide went out of print in this fall, and so we've been kicking around. And it was actually still selling very well, but the information was so out of date that both Frank Amato and I decided that it probably wasn't fair to keep pushing that book. So we pulled it off the shelves, and now I'm kind of thinking about doing the self-publishing event, something along the lines of Sierra Trout Guide. And also Lisa and I are working on a video that would be a, not Bugs of the Underworld 2, but more of a fishing instructional video, but filmed primarily from underwater so that you can see what your flies, what your retrieves, what your presentations look like, and how the trout react to them as compared to normal stuff underwater. So it's a work in progress, and we're not really rushing it. We're just having a good time doing it.
Yeah, I know that was some questions I had for later, but I might as well bring them up now. Chuck Kaminsky asked, any thoughts on Bugs of the Underworld 2?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then DB in San Diego, he says, are you going to release more videos like Bugs of the Underworld? I found it very informative. I would be very interested in seeing more videos of different bugs and how the bugs move and live underworld. The action of dragonflies in the water was very surprising. I've attended many presentations and read many articles on bugs in streams and lake. None of them describe the actions of the adult dragonflies shown in your video. Where does one expect to see the most bugs in high mountain lakes and streams? That was his question. That was quite the compliment.
Great compliment. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are people looking for Bugs of the Underworld, too.
Yeah, we feel those questions every week. And, no, we don't have a plan for Bugs of the Underworld, too. if I could change Bugs of the Underworld, it would be to shoot everything in HD. I mean, now the new cameras are so crisp that we would shoot pretty much the same thing that we shot before, but, you know, with better quality video. But I just don't know there's a demand for just that kind of ratchet up in quality of the video, because the first one was shot in pretty good stuff. But we are working on doing another video primarily underwater again, based on, you know, fish food and fishing techniques. So it's kind of a segue from just the natural history stuff to the fishing stuff.
Yeah, I know. We've discussed that on other shows about, you know, the action of, you know, for instance, when you're nymphing and the action of the flies and weights and what differences those have on, you know, the action of the flies and presentation and so forth. So if that's the kind of thing you're talking about, that would be very interesting.
That's exactly the kind of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, cool. Because there's a lot of variations there, and, of course, we can't see what's going on.
And people have a lot of preconceived notions about what's going on underwater until they see it, and then they go, oh, that's not at all what I thought was going on down there.
Yeah, well, it could change your whole fishing approach for sure. You know?
Sure it does.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah. Okay, more questions here. Joe in Texas, he says, are the golden trout of California related to the Palomino trout caught everywhere else?
Well, Palomino trout is a pretty generic term. It really doesn't refer to any kind of specific trout that I know of. I know that some rainbow trout have been called Palomino trout. I know that rainbow trout have been bred to be albinos, and then they're fed very, very strong diets rich in beta-carotene, so they turn orange or golden, and those are the golden trout you might come across sometimes in the supermarket, and sometimes those are marketed as Palomino trout. But unless he has a different fish in mind, I think that the Palomino trout is a pretty artificial fish and really not in any way related to a golden trout.
Okay. Mitchell in Southern California says, asks, what impact do brook trout have on golden trout populations? And is the bonus bag limit on small brook trout at all effective?
The bonus bag limit is, you know, people in the backcountry are encouraged to keep and kill and eat, or, you know, they have to eat them. They can't throw them on the bank. But, you know, brook trout are kind of a scourge in a lot of the High Sierra. They overpopulate. They really don't have kind of the population feedback factors that, you know, golden trout or rainbow trout or even brown trout might have. They really tend to overpopulate a water, get very stunted, and where they coincide with golden trout, they tend to outcompete the goldens because they're just so prolific. You know, they just put so many of their numbers in the same body of water that they kind of push goldens out of the system. I mean, they don't really prey on goldens, but they just take the same habitat, they eat the same food, and brookies just have not had a good presence in the High Sierra, even though they're in most of the lakes. Where brookies and golden trout historically have lived together, we're finding out now that the brookies pretty much are the only fish left in those waters.
So the only way to,
And the bonus catching, you know, with brook, I don't know what the numbers are, but you're allowed to keep a lot more brook trout than you are golden trout or rainbows or something. It doesn't seem to have any difference. In fact, a kind of an interesting study shows that brook trout in roadside waters are, the densities are no less dense than those in waters that are very seldomly visited. They're just fantastic populators.
Yeah, replace themselves quickly. Yeah. Another question, how large can golden trout grow? Are golden trout cannibalistic? I don't know where that's coming from. I think most
all trout are cannibalistic.
Yeah.
Any trout that's bigger than the trout next to it, you know, at times will eat it. And, you know, brown trout, of course, have this reputation of being, you know, hugely piscivorous, which means fish eating. But, you know, brook trout actually eat more fish than brown trout do. And rainbows and goldens really aren't too far behind them. All fish will eat young of their same species.
Sure.
There was a second part to that question. I forget what it was.
How big do the golden trout get?
Okay, I'm drawing on my memory banks here. I don't remember, but I believe the largest golden trout was caught in Cook County, Wyoming, and it was just 11 pounds and something ounces. The largest golden trout in California was about 9 pounds. But that's,
yeah, you've got in your book here, Volcano Creek was, when you wrote the book anyway, was 9 pounds, 8 ounces.
Oh, California, there you go.
Record.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
I know from experience you can't remember everything you wrote, especially those, and that could have changed too. Or maybe it's still.
Now, I would imagine, I mean, that's a pretty old record. I mean, both of those golden trout records are pretty old. And golden trout now, I mean, if you were to catch a 3 or 4 pound golden trout, that's a really big fish, you know, this time.
So Rob in Sedona, Arizona, says, Ralph, are there any spots with large goldens left? The last 15-incher I caught was at Gibbs Lake, but that lake seems to have seen diminished populations in the last few years. So,
yeah, Gibbs is a pretty easy to get to and popular lake. I mean, it's just it's a lunch hike in there. And so it does get hit a lot. So I doubt that there are many large goldens in there. But, yeah, there are quite a few lakes, actually, that punch out big goldens. And by big, I would say anything over 18 inches is a big golden. If you're really targeting big golden trout, you probably want to go west of Mount Whitney. There are several clusters of lakes in there that continue to put out good-sized golden trout, 2, 3, and even 4-pound fish.
And is that primarily where you're going to find the larger fish are in the lakes rather than the streams?
Absolutely, yeah. And probably the best lakes are going to be the lakes that have very, very limited reproduction. You're looking for a lake that might only have spawning once every 2 or 3 years, really keep the numbers of fish down, or lakes that the only spawning happens to be in 1 or 2 small spring spots. There just isn't a lot of food up there in the high country, so if you can reduce the number of fish, you're going to have more food per fish and more pound per fish.
Yeah, pretty barren, some of those high mountain lakes. Huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Got a question in here that came in on the Internet, Craig Myers in Portland. He says, about 15 years ago, while fishing the Truckee near Squaw Valley, I caught a very bright trout that I guessed to be a golden because it was such an unusual-looking trout. Could this have been a golden?
Probably not. I don't think it would have been. It might have been a brook trout. There are, it's very uncommon, but you will find brookies in the Truckee River, which are quite a bit more pretty than the browns and the rainbows. It might have also been a kokanee. There are kokanee in there, and if you caught it in the fall, they're a pretty stunning bright red fish. As far as golden trout, there are no lakes that I know of that feed into the Truckee that have goldens.
Okay. So, sorry. I thought he had one. Okay. We're talking about access here, and Shane in Saldaltna, Alaska wrote in, and he says, where are the most easily accessed golden trout areas in the Sierras, both drivable and easy hiking distance? Also, does the fishing tend to be better the further away you get from the road system, or is it body of water specific?
It's body of water specific, and there are some waters pretty close to the road, actually within four-wheel drive access, that punch out some pretty nice fish. And golden trout, you can drive right up to waters that have golden trout in them and fish. You sit on the roof of your car and fish for them. Probably the most famous would be the Golden Trout Wilderness Trailhead out of Lone Pine. And you can drive right up. It's to 10,000 feet. It's a fantastic campsite. The Cottonwood Creeks, several branches of the Cottonwood Creeks go right through the campground, and there are goldens feeding right there below your picnic tables. And so it really is not a backcountry fish. It's kind of a myth that you have to go and lose 25 pounds of sweat to find them.
Yeah, it seems to be what's out there in the media is you got to hike to get to these.
Yeah, and if you want to get big fish, if you want to get really, really big fish, you are going to have to hike. But, some of those lakes right there in the Golden Trout Wilderness Trailhead area, less than 3 miles from the trailhead, have some beautiful fish, 16, 17, 18-inch fish. You pay for that proximity to the trailhead by having to fish with a lot of people. And I think part of the allure of fishing for golden trout is being in the backcountry and being away from people and just having that solitude experience.
Right. Back when I know this was like 100 years ago, but when you did have your honeymoon.
I think that was 37 years ago.
Okay, yeah, that's what I said. Yeah, about 137. So that's a long time ago. How different was the fishing back then?
Boy, that's a good question. Probably not very different. I think the number of people that actually fish the backcountry in the Sierra just really has no impact on the numbers of fish or the quality of fish. It's kind of funny because we did our honeymoon in 1976 when popularity of backpacking was really on the upswing and probably peaked in the late 70s. When you go in the backcountry now, there are far fewer people today than than we were seeing in the mid-70s, and far fewer fishermen. And so the fishing is pretty much the same. I would say that it's as good, if not better, in some places.
Yeah, I know. You know, I know in Colorado here, it's the, and that's when I got married, was back in 1976 too. So I remember those days, and I was doing a lot of backpacking back then. What's changed here a lot in Colorado is the access, in that you have to pull permits, and some places, you know, you can't camp anymore.
Right.
I used to camp out at high mountain lakes. There's no camping at all allowed anymore.
Really?
So we've got those kind of things to contend with. But, yeah, I guess, you know, that's true around here, too. When I backpack in, I never am shoulder to shoulder with somebody fishing up in the high country, you know. If you've chosen to put on a backpack and walk, you pretty much get away from most of the crowds.
Sure you do.
Yeah, and like you say, it's kind of a unique experience. DB in San Diego wrote in, and he says his brother, now in his mid-60s, keeps thinking he wants to hike to Brainerd Lake to fish for goldens like he did 30 years ago. We were both physically okay, but not in strenuous hiking condition. He says the DFG maps shows only brookies in Brainerd Lake, but I know of other places where the DFG literature is incorrect. So is there a resource that shows what lakes have goldens and what the hike would be like?
Give me just a second here. Brainerd Lake, Big Pine Management Area. Let's see. It was last stocked with golden trout in 1973, and since then it has not been planted, and it only has a self-sustaining population of brook trout. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty accurate description from Fish and Game on this lake. They've studied it, or they've been back half a dozen times and only found brook trout. But I do agree with your caller that there actually are a lot of lakes that Fish and Game says has one kind of fish and has another kind. In fact, one very, very popular fishing lake, you know, less than a half an hour from our house, Fish and Game claims to be fishless, but you tell that to local fishing clubs. I mean, they have local fish outs where you walk in 3 miles and you're going to catch brookies, rainbows, and browns out of this supposedly fishless lake. So, yeah, you've got to look at this information with kind of a jaundiced eye. But actually, Brainerd Lake does have brook trout.
For those interested, though, the Fish and Game is the best resource?
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, given your caveats there.
Yeah, no one has the kind of information that they do. Well, I shouldn't say that. I should back up and say, if you're going to fish in the parks, Sequoia, Kings Canyon, or Yosemite National Parks, the Park Service actually has better records than Fish and Game. But outside of the parks, the rest of the state, I would say Fish and Game is your go-to source. And they're very good. They don't really punch out a lot of information about what kind of fish live where, but if you call them and ask them, and every region has a hotline, they will tell you absolutely what kind of fish are in what lake you might want to go to.
Yeah, and if they're stocking it or not.
Correct. Yeah. And the reason for this is that they used to actually give, you know, all the information about all the lakes, but since there have been the problems with the yellow-legged frog and endangered species, there's been quite a number of people have actually been translocating fish between lakes, and they're trying to stop that, and one of the ways they're trying to stop that is by not disseminating openly what kind of fish live where or what kind of fish don't live where. But if you call them and ask, say, hey, what's in Brainerd Lake, they'll tell you exactly what I just told you. It was last stocked with goldens in the early 70s, and it has brook trout now.
Yeah. So there's your case of the brook trout pushing out the goldens.
Correct.
Yeah. They're pretty aggressive little beasts.
They sure are.
Brookies are.
Yeah, brookies have no problem living shoulder to shoulder, and you know, the rainbow trout and golden trout don't quite understand that, and they're pretty easily cowed.
Yeah. So I think you probably already answered this question from Roy in Orange County. He says, where's the closest place to hike for golden trout, as I have never caught one? And then he has some equipment things like what weight rod, fly line, leader, types of flies. So we can start to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I would say anyone who wants to catch a golden trout, I mean, there are a lot of little sneaky creeks that you can go to that are roadside waters that I'm not going to talk about on the radio. But the Golden Trout Wilderness, the eastern entrance, actually both the west and the eastern entrance of the Golden Trout Wilderness in Southern California, you can park your car on top of rivers and creeks that have golden trout. And
right.
That's no secret, so I have no problem talking about that. When you're actually backpacking, probably a 5-weight rod is going to be your best rod, you're going to be way, way, way overgunned for a lot of the waters. But, you know, it can get very windy in the high country. And if you're trying to throw a hopper or a muddler minnow or something in those kind of winds, you're pretty much out of luck with much less than a 5-weight. I like to carry a 3-weight and a 5-weight. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to stick with one rod, I carry a 5-weight. And you're just your standard, you know, 9-foot, 5X leader, 5X.
Have you played around with the Tenkara rods?
I love Tenkara rods. They're great. And if I were to do a backcountry trip, fishing creeks, that's the only rod I would carry.
Yeah.
They're great. For fishing lakes, you're kind of limited, you know, and it's true that most of the fish you catch in lakes are within 20, 25 feet of the shore. But, you know, I've been in enough instances where you need to, you know, bomb out a 50 or 60-foot cast that I probably wouldn't just bring a Tenkara rod for fishing in an area with lakes. But if I were going to the Golden Trout Wilderness and fishing creeks, that would be the rod for sure.
Yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, we did.
They are.
We did a show on those, and I got a couple demo rods here. I'm just waiting for the snow to clear so I can get out and give them a try. So.
Well, you're in for it. You're in Colorado, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, Daniel, you know, the guy who started Tenkara USAs, and he moved to Colorado maybe 4 months ago. So
yeah, he just moved to Boulder. Yeah, and we were going to try to get together because he had written me in. Because I spend about half my time in Boulder and then half my time up here in Bailey, which I'm at about 8,800 feet up, just next to the wilderness area up here. So.
Oh, how cool is that?
Lots of places.
And Tenkara is something where it's really easy to do it wrong. I mean, most people will pick up a Tenkara rod and start high-sticking or dapping. And actually, it's a fishing rod. I mean, you're casting. You're making loops. You're, you know, doing little water holes and stuff. And if you could spend half a day with Daniel, you are going to learn so much more about your Tenkara rod than you would by playing by yourself.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to schedule some time with him. Yeah. Okay, Jack in Wyoming. He says, I used to fish for golden trout in the high meadows above Lone Pine, trying not to be specific here. Lone Pine, California, I guess. And other than the scenery, the hike to get to them, I was not overly impressed with them regarding bite size and eating. He says, what am I missing?
he wasn't impressed with a golden. Yeah, he's not missing anything. A golden trout is very, 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 very closely related to the rainbow. They evolved from the rainbow-like ancestor. And everything you're going to find in a golden trout, you're going to find in a rainbow trout. So if you're not really impressed with the rainbow, you're not going to be impressed with the golden, other than it's just so beautiful. But it doesn't fight any harder. It's typically a fairly dumb fish. You know, you can catch them probably easier than the average rainbow trout. Yeah, they're just cool because where they live and what they look like, and to me their evolution is pretty unique. But, you know, I'm not going to go overboard and say, yeah, they're the cat's pajamas.
Well, it's kind of like the greenback cutthroat in Colorado. You know, it's one of those for your bucket list that would be nice to hold in your hand for a second and look at and enjoy. And like you said, be in a nice place when you catch them. So, yeah, if you're looking for a rainbow that's gone to sea and come back, wrong place.
Wrong place.
Yeah. Oh, this is regarding the size of the fish. Jim Wilkins says, in the past few years, there's been blog reports and photos of taking very large golden trout out in the remote Sierra Lakes, which caused quite a controversy. I don't know what the controversy is, but he says, just how rare are these larger models? I think you already talked about that. But do you know anything about this?
Yeah, I know quite a bit about it. It's a fishing guide out of South Lake Tahoe that has done a lot of chest thumping and gone to some of these lakes, you know, again, to the west of Mount Whitney. And, you know, and not just caught them, but hang them up by the dozens on monofilament. I mean, these beautiful 2- and 3- and 4-pound golden trout. And there's no possible way that he was able to eat these. Him and his son went in there, and they, day after day after day, were catching, you know, what I think the limit's 10 fish. I'm not sure what it is. But whatever the limit was, they were catching the limit, both of them, and holding them up on stringers. And then the next day, they'd be in another lake with the same number of fish. I mean, when we're talking 12, 15 pounds of fish, and there's no way that they ate all those fish and then went to the next camp. So that's what the controversy is about, and he put it on his website, and those pictures got passed around, and he's legal. I mean, he did everything. He obeyed the law, from what I understand, but it's just...
Yeah. Sounds like those pictures from the 1940s, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. People don't do that much anymore. Well, let's see here. Will Gardner asks, for those of us that have golden on our bucket list, are there any in the Tahoe Basin? If so, are they hike-in-only destinations there?
The only place that I can think of that you could reliably catch golden trout anymore, it's not actually in the Tahoe Basin, but it's very close, would be the Needle Lakes. And these lakes are visited every day by lots of people, so I'm not, you know, it's not one of those waters I'm worried about adding a bunch of impact by naming them. And you say a hike-in, it's kind of a hike-in, but the way to get to the Needle Lakes, it's in the Granite Chief Wilderness area, is that you go to Squaw Valley Ski Area, and you take the tram to the top. And from the top of the tram, it's about a two-mile hike. So you can take the tram in the morning, go catch some golden trout, and be back down in Squaw Valley in time for dinner.
Okay.
And they're small. They're very, very, very small. I haven't seen a fish over 6 inches in those lakes, but, yeah, they're golden trout.
Doug McLean up in Calgary, Alberta, he says, have you had a chance to fish for the golden trout in any lakes in Alberta?
No, I haven't. In fact, I've never caught a golden trout out of the Sierra, and someday, somewhere, I'm going to get into the Wind Rivers and catch some of those beautiful goldens up there in the Rockies. But no, the only goldens I've ever caught have been in the Sierra.
So there are some goldens that have been stocked up in where, Wyoming? And
Yep. Well, that's where the world record is out of Wyoming. And it's, I don't know what lake it was, but it's, I know it's Cook County. I think it was 11 pounds, and apparently it was in some lake full of scuds.
That'll do it.
Sierra, we don't have many lakes with scuds in them.
Really?
Huh. No. Yeah, there are a few, but far and few between.
Yeah, lots of scuds in the Rockies here. Okay, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we'll dig a little bit more into strategies and tactics and kind of food they eat, that kind of stuff. So stick with me here, Ralph, and we'll be right back. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ralph Cutter about golden trout of the High Sierra. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Question came in on the Internet here, Ralph. Anthony in Half Moon Bay says, is there any other places to catch golden other than the Sierra, maybe up Shasta or Siskiyou County?
Oh, that would be Siskiyou County.
Siskiyou County?
Yeah, that's where Sasquatch lives.
Oh.
Sasquatch lives in Siskiyou. You know.
How's he doing, by the way?
Doing well. I'm doing well. He's expanding his range, I think. You know, Bigfoot is he's all up and down the state now. But, you know, California also has a wolf now, so I think the wolf is going to take care of Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
But, no, there. I don't know. You know, there may be, but some lakes up there in the Siskiyous that might have random golden trout in there. But I don't know of any. Going through Fish and Game websites, they have not certainly haven't authorized any plants of golden trout up in there.
Okay, another question on the Internet. I've heard that many of the lakes where goldens live are high and cold. Do you ever use a float tube, or is it not worth the effort and freezing important body parts?
It's not worth the effort. We have been leading pack trips, you know, horse pack trips for, 33 years into the high country. And early on, in 30 years ago, people really wanted to bring float tubes, and we encouraged them because you can. We have mules. You can bring them in. And year after year after year after year, the people with the float tubes were catching fewer fish than the people on shore. There was just spending more time dealing with their tubes and their waders and their fins and the wind and everything else. And I just think in the high country, there's really no reason to have a float tube. The fish mostly are close to shore. And it's just more stuff to have up there. And anymore, I just tell people flat out, don't bring your float tube.
Okay. Another question from Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California. He says, what do you think should be done about the brown trout in South Fork of the Kern River at Menachie Meadows?
Menachie Meadows, you pronounce that right. It's,
okay.
The river up there has several fish barriers, and the fish barriers were kind of just originally put into place because it was convenient to put them there, and when we got some big water years, the river and the creeks and the stringers would actually go around the fish barriers, which allowed the rainbows and the browns to get around the fish barriers. And I think what really needs to be done, and this is also what Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service believes needs to be done, is that we need to put a fish barrier well downstream of the current bottom fish barrier and use that space between those lower two fish barriers as kind of a DMZ. Fishermen are always throwing brown trout and rainbow trout over the barriers. I don't know what they're thinking. But I don't think we're ever going to get beyond that mindset. And so we need to have this kind of this DMZ where Fish and Game can go every year, every 2 years, and electroshock that space between those lower two barriers and keep those fish away from the upper elevation waters. And I don't know of any other solution that would even come close to working like that.
So what's happening is the browns are moving up into the Golden's waters and then
big time.
Yeah.
And it's an ongoing problem. I mean, the browns will move in and eat the golden trout. And even worse, the rainbows will go in and hybridize with them. And it just doesn't take very long. These creeks are very small. You can jump over most of them. And it just doesn't take long for these non-native fish to get in there and just wreak havoc. And it's extremely expensive. It takes a lot of manpower. It's a horrible waste of money trying to defeat these fish. And I think probably the better money spent would be to build another fish barrier well downstream and declare that zone between those two barriers as an interface zone where you just need to concentrate on keeping the bad fish out of that.
Yeah. Frank Wood asked, he's in Norwalk, California, he says, how early is ice out in Sierra and what's a good time to get going there?
Whew, there is a loaded question.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do our trips anymore, our pack trips. We've stopped doing that. But every year come January, we'd be just, looking at the sky and looking at long-range forecasts and trying to figure out when ice out was going to be so we could schedule our trips at ice out. And it really depends on the year and actually has less to do with how much snow you get in the wintertime than how warm it is in the spring and how fast the thaw is. And I've seen, I've been in the high country in May where you could pretty much get around in May and fish. And, a couple of years ago, most lakes were frozen in August. So I would say July 4th weekend is probably a good target, but there's no guarantees.
Yeah, it's anytime you're in the high country, it's a big unknown. I know one time we did a backpack trip here in the flat tops in the Rockies, and it was the first week in June or July, and we got up there and a ranger met us, and we were going up this slope and up to about 10,000 feet, and he says, well, are you guys prepared for winter camping? And we all go, oh, yeah, we weren't, and sure enough, we went over the ridge and a snowstorm came in. We had to hunker down in our tents and kind of shiver the night out, but, I mean, you never know,
You never know, and that's actually part of the fun of being in the backcountry, in the high country.
Sure, yeah, so, big question. And the same thing is sometimes you can maybe get the ice out, but a big problem getting into some of these places where you're going hip deep in snowdrifts and stuff, to try to
Right.
get through. Yeah, so makes it difficult. Well, let's talk a little bit about strategies and stuff. Some people have written in some questions about that. Mr. Wong from San Jose wrote in about where's the best place to go. We've pretty much talked about that. And probably as a novice, he's wanting to know best place to start would probably the Golden Wilderness area that you talked about, right?
That's what if you're going for golden trout, you can't do any better than start off in the Golden Trout Wilderness.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The east side is better than the west side, but either one works. You're going to catch fish.
Yeah.
Or at least you're going to see them.
And he asked about time of year, pretty much from ice out on.
Frozen. If you're fishing lakes, it's early in the season is best because those fish will be drawn from the lakes toward the tributaries to spawn or even in the shorelines to spawn. And then again, you know, in late September, those fish tend to move back to the shoreline because the water's warmer and you'll see them basking in the warm shorelines. But if you're fishing creeks and streams, it's open season all year. There isn't the best time to fish. They're always eating.
Okay.
They're always available.
And there's no restrictions?
No.
As far as your license goes? Okay.
No.
No season, I should say, in California.
Well, there is a season, but typically when the season opens, it's well before, you know, you can even get into the high country.
Okay.
And the open season closes, I think it's like the middle of November, and there aren't many people up in the high country in the middle of November.
Right.
The only, I should say, in the Golden Trout Wilderness, because that is where Fish and Game takes the eggs from the spawners, some of the lakes up there in the Golden Trout Wilderness are closed till I think, the July 1st weekend.
Okay.
So check your regs.
Check the regs on that. Okay. What about the Golden Trout have a preferred food?
Anything they can get in their mouth.
Kind of like brook trout, huh?
Oh, yeah. I remember Lisa and I were up there by Volcano Falls having lunch, and here are these wily Golden Trout in a pool below us, and we were eating dried figs. We were throwing the stems from the figs in that pool, and every single one got swallowed. And they were eating salami, they were eating cheese, they were eating pickles. They will eat anything they can put their mouth around.
Okay.
Probably much, much, much more important than the kind of fly you have on the end of your line is that you don't have a lot of drag on it. Golden trouts are pretty forgiving. Some of these lakes, I should back up and say, some of the lakes for goldens can be very, very tough because they key into very tiny midges, and that's all they want is a little tiny midge. But by and large, they're pretty easy to catch.
Well, when they're in the stream, that's pretty much whatever's floating by is fair game.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, again, the Sierra streams are not really productive, so, you know, the stuff they're eating are primarily from terrestrial. I mean, they're probably eating beetles and ants and grasshoppers and butterflies and stuff that actually didn't evolve from the stream. So you really don't need to worry too much about caddisfly, mayfly, stoneflies.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was a question we had come in on the Internet. Jeff in South Lake Tahoe asked about what kind of flies are you using up there in the high country. And there was a question from Larry in Pinedale, Wyoming, asking about they prefer dries, nymph streamers, and what colors seem to work best. But what you just said, we're pretty much any kind of attractors, that kind of thing.
I think one of the most famous flies is the Sierra Bright Dot. And it's got some golden pheasant tail in there. It's got some blue, and it's got some red. It's just, you know, something attractive they want to see. Your old style, Royal Coachmans, you know, those things work fine. Now, if you're going in the high country, I'd take the junk flies, the flies that you've tied that you don't like the way they look, or maybe the hooks are a little bit rusted or whatever. Those are going to work just as well as some custom-tied, you know, snazzy fly from, you know, a world-famous fly tire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Flies really don't make a difference.
Okay. This is an interesting one. Paul Weir in Grass Valley, California says, I've heard that there's potential advantage that may be had in choosing the proper hook color fishing for golden trout. Doesn't sound like that's a big deal, is it?
I've never heard that one before. I don't know.
Another one.
No, I would say it. In my experience, hook color probably isn't relevant.
Yeah. What kind of? This is from Jeff in Sacramento. Wants to know: what kind of role does UV material play in visibility in fly tying materials for trout? He says, I'm not specifically golden.
That's a loaded question, Jeff. I would say, you know, there has been a lot of push in the market in the last 2 years about UV reflectance and fly tying materials. The fact is that most fly tying materials naturally have some sort of UV reflectance. And the things that trout eat have some sort of UV reflectance. If you look at the pictures of ultraviolet pictures of mayflies, stonefly, caddisflies, you'll see that there's quite a bit of UV reflectance in the damselflies and dragonflies, some in the mayflies, very little in the caddisflies, and none in the stoneflies. So it's just another color. It's just a color that we can't see, so that you can have a lot of, you know, Barnum and Bailey kind of stuff revolving around UV reflectance. But I would not go tie flies that are totally UV reflectant any more than I would tie a fly that's completely red. Mm-hmm. It's just another color.
I think when we it was interesting to me, the last show that we did together, Fishfood, you know, you were talking about your underwater studies and so forth, and that so much of it's kind of like the fig stems. So much goes in and out of the mouth that we don't know about for these fish. It was just incredible to me to hear you talk about that, where it was more about us not sensing the strike and so forth than
correct
whether it went in or out the mouth. And you know, that was surprising to me. Because we talk so much about matching the hatch at times, but the way you described it back then, you said they were taken in gravel and sticks.
Oh, sure. In fact, I just got done, or Lisa and I just got done, giving a show 3 days ago to the Granite Bay Flycasters, and one of the best parts of the show is about 2 minutes of video of just sitting in a Sierra stream watching golden trout eating everything that comes by. And it's, I mean, they don't miss a beat. And you drift a nymph in there, and three or four or five fish in a single drift will inhale that nymph and spit it out, but not even move the split shot. I mean, they just, it's so subtle that the person on the, you know, the dumb end of the rod just doesn't have a clue. You know, probably the best thing you could do to increase your hookup rate is to, you know, make a hook set every 2 or 3 seconds, just a subtle little hook set, and by accident you're going to be hooking these guys.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about some more strategies for the High Sierra. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? Well, with the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles, classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ralph Cutter about golden trout of the High Sierra. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. You know, Ralph, back when I asked you what was going on in your fly fishing world, I forgot to ask you then what your domain name, your URL for your website is, so that people can check up on what you're doing. And
oh, we're at www.flyline.com.
www.flyline.com.
Pretty easy. Yep. And actually, on the website, there's quite a bit of information in there about fishing for golden trout and about fishing in the Sierra in general.
Good, good, good. There you go, folks. Here's a question that came in on the Internet. It says, what gear do you take up in the high country besides fishing gear for a day trip, especially when one fishes alone?
Boy, as little as possible. I'm really, 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 I don't know, I'm against that. I don't carry the 10 essentials that you see in all the Boy Scout books and stuff. I don't carry a cell phone. I don't carry a compass. Just, I pretty much carry what I need. An extra shirt, you know, a warm shirt, maybe a lighter or some matches, and a pocket knife, and pretty much leave it at that. And maybe I'm being irresponsible by, you know, saying that over the radio or over the Internet, but you know, I've been doing this a long time, and I've really never run into a need to have a bunch of extra stuff. And maybe, you know, in this day and age, maybe bringing a cell phone is a smart thing to do, because it's amazing where you can get cell phone reception in the high country, but it just kind of goes, no, it just goes against my grain.
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing is to have some kind of, you know, waterproof matches, that kind of thing, so that you can get a fire going.
One thing and that some common sense.
Yeah. One thing I remember going to a hunter safety class once, and they did a movie on survival and so forth. And they had a true story of a guy that had walked in fishing for the day and fell in the creek, and it was cold, and he didn't bother to dry off, and he started walking and got hypothermic, and then they found him dead under a tree. So that was a simple thing of just trying to dry out and keep warm,
Right.
But, we're not always that smart. Like you said, we're on the dumb end of the rod sometimes. But it doesn't take much to get hypothermic, and I think that's the biggest thing that people should probably worry about.
Yeah, hypothermia is a big thing. Lightning is a big thing. There are, it's so hard to say because we've been doing this for so long that you just kind of take for granted that everyone understands that, when you get wet, you better get dry or you better get out. Or you better get warm. And, I think maybe I'm underplaying, the risks that are involved. But for the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people that go in the backcountry, it's a pretty safe place.
Yeah, it definitely. I know here, you mentioned lightning up in the upper high mountain meadow here above Timberline several years ago. Lightning took out a whole herd of elk.
Really?
Went up there, and there was like 30 elk dead in a field.
Already cooked.
Lightning strike. Yeah. Very weird. Of course, that's like a once in a lifetime thing probably, but pretty interesting. Yeah. And up in that area, I've backpacked through there. There's a lot of bristlecone pine and so forth up there, and it looks kind of like a battlefield up there. these trees are burnt out and stuff, and you go, whoa, I wonder what happened here,
Right.
But it's kind of like a high lightning area for some reason. It targets that ridge. But anyway. So, see here. Greg Simpson, Rapid City, South Dakota, found that when sight fishing for goldens, that they are interested in a fly, wet or dry, for about one or two passes, and then they're not interested any longer. If I switch to a different fly, then they're interested again. Do you see this pattern?
Yes, but not specifically with golden trout. With rainbows and browns and brookies, I see the same kind of deal where they might show some interest in the first pass, and whatever they decided to turn them off, it keeps them turned off. And if you change the size a little bit or the shape a little bit or the color a little bit, they want to get reacquainted with this thing going down the river. So, yeah, I'm sure that goldens do that, but I'm not sure that they do it any more than other trout species.
Okay. You mentioned a few flies, but there were some questions about what your go-to flies for goldens are. And also, Bruce in California want to know very specifically which one dry fly in August would you use to catch goldens in the high field?
Well, my go-to dry fly is the EC caddis. It's the emergent cripple caddis. It's kind of like a Swiss Army knife of flies. You can push the wing up. It looks like a mayfly. You can smash it down. It looks like a caddis fly or a midge or even a stonefly. It's a good little attractor pattern. So that happens to be what I use. But, realistically, I think an elk hair caddis would work well, a little stimulator. Ants are really a great pattern up in the high country. Size 14 ant is going to be as good as anything in the world. Again, these fish are really, really, really opportunistic, and I wouldn't go, I wouldn't step 2 feet to pick up a specific fly to represent a specific bug when you can have something that's very generalistic and will attract all kinds of fish across the spectrum.
Hey, George in Alabama want to know about the never-fail streamer that you might use.
Oh, I wish I knew. Woolly bugger is pretty hard to beat. Okay. I think, probably a green beadhead woolly bugger is about as good a streamer as you're going to find. And plus, they're easy to tie and easy to lose.
Ed Templeton in California, he says, during your last visit to the show, you mentioned drift fishing without an indicator. He says, I'm past the bobber stage and would like to hear more detail about your method. So he's talking about nymphing without an indicator. Want to give people any tips on that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real beauties about fishing in the high country. It's very intimate. The water is very clear. And typically, you can get pretty close to these guys. There's always a willow or an alder or a rock you can get behind. So it's very visual. And if you can kind of high-stick a nymph to these fish, even if you can't see the nymph, if you watch the fish, observe the fish, and you see it turn briefly or open its mouth briefly and set the hook, 9 times out of 10, you're going to hook that fish. You know, even though you can't see your fly, you're watching the reaction of the fish, and which to me is a wonderful thing. It's almost as good as dry fly fishing. So I think once you start, you know, putting that little motion, putting that little sense of tug you might get or straightening of the line in the high country waters, you can translate that to bigger waters, going down to the current or the Truckee or the Kaweah or wherever. And again, maybe you won't see the fish, but you're going to sense that tightening, that little rubbery feeling in your line that means there's a fish out there. Indicators, I think, 9 times out of 10 are actually counterproductive. There are definitely times when they're great and I use them, but most of the time I don't.
Okay. Paul, the rooter up in Yukon, Canada, asks, what's the most common colors of midge mergers up in the high country lakes?
Oh, boy, probably greens and black, I would think, maybe gray. They're, against the sky, they're all going to look dark. I wouldn't worry about the color. I just use something like a dark gray or a black or a brown. You know, they're all going to look pretty much the same against the sky.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any presentation techniques, so to speak, for fishing the lakes in particular?
No. I think one of the biggest mistakes, though, that people make when they're fishing lakes, and it's almost always windy in the Sierra, is that they fish with the wind at their back. And they fish with the wind at their back so they can make long, nice casts, and it keeps their loops from tailing. But the second the fly hits the water, it's dragging because the wind is blowing from your back through your line and the fly, and your fly is taut to your line. And any of the naturals are going to be drifting with the wind, and your fly is anchored to the line. And it looks absolutely artificial. So I think as far as a presentation technique, one of the best things you could do is to position yourself on a lake or even a river so you're casting into the wind. Now, it might be a little tougher, a little more difficult, but if you cast into the wind when that fly hits the water, it's drifting back towards you just like all the naturals are. So if I were to give one tip on presentation in a lake in the high country, it would be cast into the wind.
That's pretty good, yeah. Or I guess if you had no choice, then short cast it and let it float out, huh?
Yep, throw some slack in there.
Yeah. I don't know where this came from, but Paul in the Yukon again asked about fishing a bird's nest with float and how deep can a person sink the fly before bubbles will no longer stay on the fly.
Ooh, I don't think that depth has anything to do with the retaining of bubbles on the fly. I think you can go as deep as you want, and whether you're using a sink tip or a full sinking line or a bunch of split shot, of course, as you go deeper and deeper, the bubbles are going to get smaller because it's just the pressure of the water, but I don't think it's going to make the bug want to release those bubbles.
Mm-hmm. Was that, do I remember that as being one of your favorite flies from our life?
Absolutely. I love the bird's nest, and I really like the bird's nest with a desiccant powder on it. The bird's nest is a really scraggly fly. It holds the powder really well. And then when the bubbles are formed, it gives a lot of surface area for the bubbles to hang on to. So a bird's nest underwater with desiccant on it is a fabulous, fabulous combination.
Okay. Joe in Texas want to know, is there a good dry dropper combo to use for golden trout?
I never bother.
Yeah.
I really never bother. It's, you know, goldens are very opportunistic, and, you know, they're probably going to eat a number 14 or number 16 yellow humpy as much as they're going to eat anything else. And I'm just throwing that out there as a fly. I could say, you know, royal wolf or whatever. But I just have never in my life found the need to use a hopper dropper for goldens.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, if you see them on the bottom of a river and they're eating nymphs, actively eating black fly larvae or something on the bottom, and they won't come up, you're going to have to go down and get them. But I would just stick with a nymph then rather than a hopper dropper.
Yeah. Now, you pretty much answered this before, but I'll throw this out there again in case you want to add to it. Steven in San Francisco wrote in. He says, I want to catch a large golden as opposed to plenty of smaller goldens. He said, what would you look for? A glacier above a lake to increase its fertility, maybe limited spawning area, which is what you mentioned before, or limited spawning, so that the population of goldens will be less, giving fewer trout more food to eat. And that's pretty much what you said before. Is there anything
yes.
else he should look for?
No, I think he nailed it on the head. And if he just wrote that statement down and followed his own directions, he's going to do well. I mean, he's obviously a thinking fisherman, and there's not much I could add to that.
Okay, good. You know, we kind of talked about that again, flies. Paul, and I don't know, this is pretty specific, but I'll throw it out there, and if you don't know, you don't know. He says, I fished Thousand Island Lake in the Ansel Adams Wilderness in August and was skunked. Can you give me some tips on how to fish it and where in this large lake? He says, I could see some reddish minnow-sized fish in the lake. What are they? Do you have any
It's funny you should
that?
Ask that question following on the last answer I gave you about black fly larvae. At the outflow of Thousand Island Lake, which is the headwaters of the San Joaquin River, at the outflow of the lake is a log that crosses that creek there, which is the San Joaquin, and that's the John Muir Trail. And if you stand on that log and look downstream and you look hard, you're going to see all kinds of white little flashes, and those are trout feeding. It's like a perfect little classroom for watching trout mouths open and close. They're all eating black fly larvae, which are about a size 18 or size 20, and all you need to do is wrap some black thread on a hook, and you've done a great job of imitating that. So the outflow of Thousand Island Lakes would be a great place to fish, and probably even better and a lot more fun is to go to the Ritter and Banner side, the west side of the lake. Those glaciers are melting. The water goes underground and then repercolates up through the peat on the west end of the lake in the water. And you'll see good-sized fish swimming back and forth, and they are stirring up the bottom, and they'll kick up the bottom of their tail, then they'll immediately turn around and swim through their cloud of silt, you know, pretty much like bonefish do. And they're knocking up things like midges and caddis larvae and that kind of stuff. So I would fish the peat bogs on the west side of the lake, or I'd fish the outflow at the east side of the lake. As far as those little red minnows, I don't have a clue.
Okay. Okay. Okay, this is an interesting question, not specific to the golden, but it would be interesting to hear what you have to say. Steve Goodchild in the UK wrote in, and he says he enjoyed our previous interviews, and he's looking forward to this one. He says, how does the average fisherman discipline himself to learning one way of fishing before he gets the bug to start another method of fishing or learn how to catch another species of fish? It takes years to learn a method properly, but there are so many good things out there to try, and you get diluted and lose the special touches. It's the shiny object syndrome, it sounds like.
That's a great question, because there have been many seasons I've started out and say to myself, you know, this year I'm only going to fish dries, or this year I'm only going to do this or that. And, in fact, this year I'm starting out with a switch rod and really trying to figure out how to use a switch rod.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to his question, because I never follow through with my plan and always revert back to, you know, regular fishing and just kind of experiment here and there. And just given time, it all kind of comes.
Yeah, I know a friend of mine who I did have on the show, and we did a show on damsels and dragons, and Rich Palatsky. He does do that, and that's how he really gets tuned in. He'll say, I'm just going to fish damsels, you know, while they're in season. That's all I'm going to do, and I'm going to learn the ins and outs of those critters, and he does. And he becomes very expert in each of those areas. So some people do have the discipline to do that kind of thing. And
yeah, I don't. Sometimes I wish I did, but, you know, when I find myself kind of grooving into one thing, it almost becomes a task or a job, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I want to make a longer cast and just catch that fish.
Right. These are, this one, Joe in San Francisco asked about where would you go in May? Is there any part of the Sierra that is open in May to fishing?
Yeah, I would, you know, obviously I would go to the lower latitudes. You early in the season, you know, the southern end of the range is going to, you know, become ice-free much sooner than you will up, like, let's say, at Tahoe or Mammoth. So I would start out there and fish the Kings, the Kaweah, the Kern, and just move north as the season progresses. But in May, you can have some very good fishing down there.
Oh, interesting here. Ralph, we just got some information from Craig in Portland on the Internet here. This is regarding search and rescue. He says he does search and rescue here in Oregon. And he says, please tell Ralph and your listeners to always at least bring your cell phone on remote trips like this. He says, you don't have to use it, but if something happens like a broken leg, we can ping your location, even if you don't have coverage. He says, this is crucial in the backcountry. I never knew that. I just always thought my cell phone was useless up there, but evidently they can ping it.
That sounds like a good piece of advice.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you don't have to have it on or anything, I guess, but if you did get in trouble, you could turn it on, and maybe that would be a way, or, you know, somebody walking out could find you if you don't have a GPS. But
right.
That's what I always carry. I always carry a GPS, especially if I'm with somebody that's not as familiar with the area as I am, and figuring, again, if I broke my leg, I could send them out and put a waypoint in it, and they could come back and follow.
And come get you.
Yeah, yeah, but... So we're pretty much out of time here. There were two more questions. Let me throw this out, because I know this is right up your alley. That came in on the Internet. Ron in Fair Oaks wrote in, and he says, I want to study some of my local water by snorkel. I know you have experience with this. What should I expect, and what is the most important thing to look for besides fish? You have any tips on the underwater stuff?
Yeah, he's in Fair Oaks, which is on the American River, which would be a very benign, easy river to start out with, either the American or the Yuba, which is just north of him. I think maybe your first drift, you should just go downstream and relax and just see what you're going to see, knowing that you're going to scare fish as you go by and you're not going to get a very close look. But maybe on your second pass after you've gotten up on the bank and warmed up again is to swim to the riverbed and start pulling yourself upstream against the current. Your silt plume will be behind you instead of in front of you. And also, when you're hanging onto the rocks, it forces you to look right on the rock in front of you, and you'll just be astounded. You'll be stunned at all of the cool stuff that's right there within a foot of your face mask. And so I would definitely recommend going upstream, hanging onto the bottom, and don't worry about swimming. Just pull yourself along the riverbed with, you know, obviously in water that's shallow enough that your snorkel sticks out.
Sounds like a good tip. Sounds like a good one, yeah. Okay, and one final question here, comment. Ron in Fair Oaks, same guy, says, Ralph, how the heck did you get your wife to fly fish, or did she always love it? I really wish I could share my passion with my wife. You're so lucky.
I am so lucky. I am so lucky, and I never really got Lisa to fly fish. She just got it. I mean, again, it was... Our first backpacking trip before our honeymoon, we went up to Minaret Lake and did the hill over to Nidiver, and it was just as simple as having one of those eagle claw, you know, spin and fly rods, those yellow rods, and she put on some generic, you know, I don't know, Royal Coachman or something, and dabbed it in a pool, and a nice brook trout came out and got it, and she was hooked more than the fish was. So there wasn't any... There was no prodding there.
Yeah, you're just lucky, huh?
Yeah.
So there you go, Ron. Sounds like you're not so lucky, but but I know there's a lot of partners, doesn't have to be male or female, that love to just go sit on the bank and hang out with you, too, which is just as fine sometimes, you know, and that makes for a great day for both of you, too. So, well, that's about it. We're out of time. But we are going to be giving away a few things here, and including Ralph's book on fish food, courtesy of Stackpole, and that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So everybody stick with me here, and Ralph, stick with me a few more minutes so we can give that book away. I might need your help on deciding whether I'm getting the right answer or not here to our questions. So we'll be right back and do those giveaways, give away those prizes. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more about what's going on and how you can get involved. Again, it's SaveBristolBay.org. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database, and it's a little too late to register for that now, but do that before the next show, and so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these prizes. But if you are one of the lucky winners, we're going to contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So that's how we'll take care of that. So the first thing that we're going to give away is 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you're not familiar with the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. It's, again, a great organization to support and be part of. And let's just see here. We have a winner, Bruce Jensen in California. Bruce Jensen in California. So congratulations, Bruce. That 1 year membership to the Federation. And we'll be in touch, get your information from you so that we can get that membership started for you. And our next winner, and this is for 1 year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal from Amato Books. To find out more about Amato and all the publications they have to offer, just go to amatobooks.com. And looks like George Hall in California as well, George Hall. So congratulations, George, on winning that when your subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal from Amato. So congratulations. Sorry, folks, I just couldn't get this thing to respond to me. Okay, let's give away Ralph's book, Fish Food. It's a great book, folks. You're going to really love it if you win this. And if you don't, you can find it on Amazon, of course, probably at your website too, right, Ralph? If
yes.
You want to get maybe an autographed copy, you could order it from Ralph. And
you can do that.
And Stackpole Books also, another source for all of Ralph's books there. And so check that out. So let's got to ask a question here. This is a two-part question. I want to know the area that Ralph talked about that was probably the easiest accessible area to go after Goldens and a place to start. I want to know what that area is. And I want to know one of the primary flies or favorite flies that Ralph talked about during the show. So that's kind of open-ended, but he did talk about a couple of his favorites, and that's what I want to know. So, Ralph, let's see. We'll keep refreshing the screen here, see what kind of answers we got coming in. They're kind of slow tonight. Still checking.
That's a hard question.
No, it's not. If I ask them too easy, then they answer it before I ask the question. I'm serious. These guys anticipate what the question's going to be. Okay, here's an answer. The answer is Golden Trout Wilderness Area. Does he have that right?
Perfect.
And the fly is Sierra Bright Dot.
Oh, yeah, good one.
Okay, so David Underwood, Walnut Creek, California, you just won a copy of Ralph's book, Fish Food, so congratulations. Good job on that. So David, I've got your email address here, but please, and you can do it in the same box you submitted the question, send me your mailing address as well so that I have that and we can get that book shipped out to you from Stackpole. So that's terrific, so congratulations. Well, Ralph, I really appreciate you being on with us again, and we finally got it done. I apologize for all the other times, but, you know, it happens.
It happens, you know, and it was fun. Thank you again for inviting me back to your show.
Yeah, it was great. It was great, and thanks for being here. Folks, I know you've all, this is more for new people joining us, which we have people join us every day. Be sure to check out the archive on our website. We have over 160 shows in that archive right now, so just an incredible source of information. So be sure you dig in there and do some searches, keyword searches in the archive. You're going to find all kinds. And be sure to listen to Ralph's previous interview on fish food. You're going to find that one very, very interesting. Learn some things that you probably hadn't even thought about around fish food. So that's a great, great show that we did. Our next broadcast will be on April 3rd. And 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and we're going to be interviewing Terry Wilson, and our topic for the show will be crappie fly fishing. Terry Wilson and his wife Roxanne have explored the life of the crappie and found many good things about a fish that hasn't gotten much respect in the past. Crappie are voracious feeders and strong fighters, and you can fish for them nearly year-round. Listen in to hear about crappie behavior, habits, how to catch them, and what flies to use. And we'll see you on that show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Keeney's Fly Shop, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.